would, please turn with me to Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews chapter 12. And we're going to undo a commonly held belief today by some preachers and many congregants. Now, I tell you, I had great joy when a friend of mine called me up and asked me about this passage that we're to look at here in the first verse of chapter 12. He was doing some reading, looking at the context. That will always get you. If you're ever looking for the meaning of something, no matter what someone has said, if you look at the context, it's going to undo some of your most cherished theologies. And he was looking at the context and realized what he had been taught all these years was way off base pertaining to verse 1. I affirmed his suspicions and told him that 99.9%, that's not an exaggeration. I would say, now I haven't done a study, but I would put it this way. I'm not talking about 99.9% of my commentaries. I'm talking about 99.9% of times from the time that Christ died till now would hold to what, well, let's say to his new view, which isn't so new if you were to read the early church fathers, and anyone up to this time, including your pastor, would hold. Yet the 0.1% seems to be taught in most churches today on this view. Now, what text am I speaking of? Again, it's verse 1, Hebrews 12, verse 1. Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. Amen. And you know now what I'm referring to, a great cloud of witnesses. The teaching today, and I don't actually, you know what, I really don't mean all the teaching. There's just one group in particular that really teaches this way and has. And it's the group, I mean, I don't, you know what? Never mind. Never mind. A lot of it that we are taught today, we're taught because of what comes from the pulpit, and I don't mean to slam people that have this belief or have been taught this belief that they're ignorant of history or languages, because a lot of it I would put on the pulpit, not on the people that have sat underneath that particular teaching or view for some time. So I'll let that go. But here's what many people will do with the text that we have here, and here's what they will say about the great cloud of witnesses. And here's what they're going to say. They're going to say, the writer is saying that we have this great cloud of witnesses. That is, all the people in Hebrews 11 are witnessing what you're doing. They're looking down and they're watching you. You see, you're running a race. You're in a coliseum, is what they're saying there, you see, the metaphor for the race. And they're watching everything that you do, so you need to persevere. You need to, because good old Abe and Isaac and Rahab, and them, they're all watching you. And to that, I would just ask, just on the surface, isn't the fact that God is watching you enough? That God is watching all of your actions? Would that even be enough? They say, yes, I know that God is watching. But what really encourages me or motivates me is to know that that faithful Enoch that walked with God is watching me. Now, what is the other problem there that you would see with that view for someone that holds that view? And right, you begin to assign godly attributes to the souls of man. We know they don't have their bodies, now it's just going to be to their souls of man. We say God is omnipresent, that he's everywhere all the time. Well, if Enoch is watching your every move, right, in Twin Peaks, and Enoch is watching my every move in Cedar Pines Park, or somebody's every move in the valley, or my son's every move in Boston, all at the same time, then that means Enoch has attributes that we say to people that whenever we're trying to show God and how God is special, that we say only God has. That's what makes him God. I mean, this is one of the big, would be the biggie. Well, I guess being all powerful would be pretty big too. But omnipresent, that's big. So this is one of the big attributes of God that we say only God has. But then, because of a light outlook on education or reading commentaries or history or grammars that many have today, we come across this text, and realizing it or not, if we take it the way I've just described, we throw out everything we've just said about God and his attributes, of what makes God God. And we do that because we're taking a 2011 or a 1998 or a 1984 or a 1972 reading of this text. Now, not only are, or should I say, not only that, we are now encouraged. If this is true, if this scenario is true, we're now encouraged to be faithful because a man or woman is watching us and not God himself. Now, you can see why they may get that impression aside from the word witness. Look at verse 1. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and sin that clings so closely, and let us run the race with endurance, the race that is set before us. So, you see what they said. You're surrounded by witnesses. That is the context of people watching. So you can see the metaphor there. They're watching. What are they watching? They're watching an Olympic race. They're watching a race. They're in a Colosseum watching you, so you'd better run well, or I don't know, maybe one of them's going to think ill of you. I'm not sure. So let us examine a few things first. The word witness, that would be a good place to start. The word witness we use today as a spectator, as in watching an Olympic game. The football game is on, or it was on yesterday, and I say something, they go, listen, I witnessed that game myself. But what if we looked at the meaning of the word itself? And here's the thing. Not using a Greek dictionary at this time, okay? I want to use an American dictionary at this time, which we got to be careful whenever we do that, right? But if that's a English word, witness, how is it actually used? Not the way that we use it at times, but how is it actually used in Webster's dictionary, the word witness? Now listen to this. Tell me if this sounds like anything you may have read in the last chapter. Definition 1. Attestation of a fact or an event. A testimony. Definition 2. One that gives evidence, this is for witness, one that gives evidence, specifically one who testifies in a cause or before judicial tribunal. The next one, one who has personal knowledge of something. Something serving as evidence or proof, public affirmation by word or example of usually religious faith or conviction. That's Webster's. You see, even the English dictionary knows it's not a spectator. Did you find in Webster's anywhere under the word witness? Forget the Greek right now. We're going to get to the Greek. But did you find anywhere in Webster's where it says it's a spectator? Or someone that watches? No. Someone that testifies in a cause, someone that gives evidence, an attestation of a fact or testimony. Public affirmation by word or example. That wouldn't have anything at all to do with Joseph's affirmation or Rahab's example or Rahab's... No, it couldn't be anything at all to do with that. Now, is there anywhere that it says under Webster's, and that's the full Webster's dictionary, you can go to American Oxford Dictionary, it's going to give you the same, just a little bit different setup, anywhere that it says the word witness means spectator, watcher, or audience? It's not in there. As you know, I've been an expert witness for years. So I know a little something about this word. So you can tell it's easy to find the context then. But I was an expert witness for years. And what did I do? I gather evidence and I testify to the truth of what I know to be true. That's what an expert witness does. Now, you may witness a car accident, but you are called a witness not necessarily because you saw, but because the cops want you to testify to what you know to be true, right? That's why you say, I witnessed the accident. Well, you did see it, but that's not what makes you a witness. What makes you a witness is that you witness. What do you do whenever you witness to someone? You know, can I get a witness? You witness. You witness to people. You testify. You don't see them. You don't sit there and watch them, do you? No, you witness to them. It's the same thing here. A witness is not someone who sits in the stands and watches people unless they later witness or testify about what they saw while they were sitting in those stands. A spectator watches. A witness testifies. Now turn back to Hebrews 11. Hebrews 11. I want to show you a little something here. And this is where the language usage would help. But I'll show you something here. And then in a minute we will get to the Greek, but I just want to show you something. And then actually you may even have part of the notes in your Bible, or if you have the study notes or in the margin or something like that. But here we go. Verse 1 of Hebrews 11. Now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. For by it the people of old received their commendation. Stop right there. The word commendation is the same word used in Hebrews 12:1 for witness. That's strange. For by their faith they were commended by God. That is, by their faith they obtained a good report, as some of your translations may say. Were testified of. Actually, if you were to use a literal Young's, if any of you use the old Young's literal translation from the Greek, it would be, they were testified of by God. That's the same word for witness in 12:1. Namely, they were testified of favorably, right, in Hebrews 11. Not only men, but God gave testimony to their faith. God testified of their faith, or he commended, or he gave a good report. The very thing a witness does, he gives a report or testifies in some way. It's the exact same word that's used in 12:1. Now, you know what? There's a term for this for all of you English teachers out there, but the way I've been teaching you since we've been going through church history and other things is that we call that kind of bookends. That's what we'll call it. Okay? And that's where you have a word that begins a certain discourse that's used. And then you have a word at the end of that discourse. Okay, and here we have the word witness, and then we have the word witness, and where is it? The very beginning of Hebrews 1, well, Hebrews 11, forget the chapters. The word witness is used right before he speaks of the faith of those men and women, and the word witness is used right after he speaks of those that were testifying of their faith through words and deeds. And that's called a bookend. That we always want to, anytime you're reading, you see, you can't see it in English. You know, because it says one commended, and then over here it says we have witnesses, and you know, in the English you wouldn't know, but that's it. That's a bookend, but it doesn't even stop there. It doesn't stop there. Usually what you have with a bookend is you have a word that's used, it keys us, and then it ends and it keys us. And everything in between has to do with the bookends. Okay? Which is kind of what we have. But look it down at verse 4 of chapter 11. By faith, Abel offered to God a more acceptable sacrifice than Cain, through which he was commended as righteous. God commending him by accepting his gifts. And through his faith, though he died, he still speaks. Yes, that's right. The word there for commending in both places there in that text is the same word that's used in 11:2, the same word that's used in 12:1. You see, witness. So if you were reading the Greek, it would say, well, it wouldn't say witness because that's English, but it would say witness, all within one sentence. And then he's going to speak about all these people that testified of what they believed, either in word or deed. And then he says, since we have this great cloud of witnesses. Now then, it's the same word to choose. Would you substitute, let's just take this text here, it's kind of fun to do that. Would you substitute, he watched as righteous God watching him by accepting his gift. You see, instead of commending. You see, because if we were to read it like this, we'd say, by faith, Abel offered to God a more acceptable sacrifice than Cain, through which he watched as righteous God watching him by accepting his gift. God spectating? God as an audience? No. But if we did it in a different way, we would see this. God testified of his being righteous by accepting his gifts. In verse 2, he is showing all of the people he's about to mention have testified concerning their faith. And in verse 1 of chapter 12, after showing how Moses and Rahab and all testified concerning their faith, either in word or deed. Right? In word or deed. Isn't that what kind of James talks about also? In word or deed. Therefore, because we have all these folks that have testified concerning their faith, he says in 12:1, and then he starts going on to tell us now, what do we do that we have all these people that have testified concerning their faith? Now, one more note, and I don't want to get too technical, but the word for witness here is marturon, or ron, actually, marturon. That's where we get our word martyr from. But don't think of martyr as in martyr, because that came later during the persecutions. You know how word uses changes, right? Over time, they change over use. Martyr didn't mean martyr whenever he's writing Hebrews here, okay? But marturon, that's the word here. Do you know what the word, if you get any Greek lexicon, pick up any Greek lexicon, I don't care if it's one today, printed by, you know, unbelievers of America, or, you know, whatever, or if you use BDAGs, or if you use Linnell's, whoever you want, any Greek lexicon, look up the word martyron. And all it's going to say is one who bears testimony. It will say nothing of seen, nothing of any of that, it just says one who bears testimony. It does not mean, at least at the time, one who dies for their faith. Okay, understand, whenever they wrote Hebrews here, whenever Hebrews was written, it did not mean that. That doesn't come to meaning for another 100 or so years. About another 100 years, something like that. In the Muslim faith, martyr means one that died for the faith while killing people, right? That's generally the way we look at it. Fly a plane into a building, you're called a martyr. Are you testifying of your faith? Well, some would say by deed or act, but in a sense, you're not testifying of your faith. Okay, but you're dying for your faith, right? But you're killing people in the process. That's how they use that word martyr. We need to understand it's used differently. Now, in the early church, the one meant, as in Hebrews, one who bears testimony. That's all it means in any Greek lexicon. But through usage, centuries later, it came to mean, or was used of those that died because of their faith. Okay? They testified of the truth. They were arrested and told to recant. They would not recant their faith, thereby testifying of their faith. The end result was they died. Then they were called martyrs. But not martyrs because they died. They were called martyrs because they bore a testimony of their faith. They died as a result of it, but they were called martyrs for that. Now we look at a martyr as someone that has died because of their faith. But you are a martyr, in the Greek sense of the term, like these are, if you are testifying or bearing testimony or giving a defense for the faith that is inside you. Okay. Rahab, we saw, bore testimony of her faith by welcoming the spies and putting her life on the line, right? That's how the writer said she testified of her faith. Okay. Joseph bore testimony of his faith, not by actions, but by giving instructions concerning his bones, you see? So a testimony of faith can be by words or deeds. And that's why we read with these different ones. There are words and deeds that the writer of Hebrews 11 is using here. So no, people don't receive what they claim only God has in omnipresence. And that's why I have a pet peeve with this verse, because I don't like people giving dead people the attributes of God. Whenever on earth we would say only God has those attributes. Okay? God testified as righteous, testified them as righteous because they testified or bore witness to their faith by various words or deeds. Now, he wants to take all that he has just said, because he says in verse 1, therefore, so everything he says there now is going to be applied to their lives, right? Because he says in 12:1, he says, therefore, since we have, what's the therefore? All of these testimonies that we've just had of faith, now the people have to apply them to what he's about to say here. Okay, now then let's see if we can move on. Verse 1 in Hebrews 12. Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. Now, he does use the metaphor of games or a race here, and I think that's where that whole thing got started. It's because, well, you see a metaphor of a race, you know, yes, that's true, but that would still doesn't equal in Greek or English that word meaning that, and it doesn't line up with the context of Hebrews 11 either. Now, he calls these people a cloud of witnesses. Are you familiar? That is a term that is used throughout much Greek literature. For those that have read the Iliad or read it twice because they didn't take notes the first time or whatever it was, or with Homer, right? What a shame. Well, never mind. They know another Homer instead of this one, but out of time. Okay. Homer in the Iliad, he uses the term as well, and he calls it a great or a cloud of witnesses. Now, the writer of the Hebrew calls it a great cloud of witnesses, which is a comparative thing and one that is to show the stature of these people. So, this is a group of people. If you look in Greek literature, it's a term that was used, I don't know, we might say a throng now, I suppose, or I don't even know what we would use today for something like that, but it's basically, it's just a phrase that's used for a whole bunch of people. It's called a cloud of people. We have this great cloud of people. So it's we are surrounded by this group of people, this throng of people, okay? And there's a little play on words here. He says, okay, you know you're surrounded by all of these faithful people, this great cloud of people throughout history. Some we didn't even have time to mention. He mentions, remember, later on. Some we didn't have time to mention. There's so many of them that surround us that it's much like in a sense, it is like a cloud. That's a picture that's used there, that is just so much of it. It surrounds you, that you have a witness, that you're encompassed with faithful men and women that have stood their ground in word and deed. That's my exaggerated translation of that. You have a great cloud of witnesses. Now he says, because of that, let us lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. There's actually a little word picture that's going on here. Again, in the English, it doesn't come out. But you're surrounded by a great cloud of faithful people that stood their ground. And then look what he says. Let us lay aside every weight. And then he says, which clings so closely. It's just like the great cloud that you're surrounded by. You have sin that is clinging so closely to you. And it's kind of a word picture in the language that you have two things that you're surrounded by. Sin that is clinging so closely that's going to hinder you, and you're going to get entangled on it, right? If you don't, you know. And you have both. You have two things. You have two things that surround you. You have a great cloud of witnesses that surround you. And he says, and sin which clings so closely. So you have a cloud of people all around you, and you've got sin that is also clings closely. The idea of the cloud encompassing you and sin which clings so closely, like I said in the language, it shows up. You got both things right there. And so both are surrounding us. Both are within reach, if you will. One is sin, and the other helps us keep us from falling away. Remember, that was the whole idea of Hebrews 11, right? Was to help us from falling away, not going on sinning deliberately, and all those things in Hebrews 10. Sin is around us, but a way out is around us too, is basically what he's told us here. It's reminiscent of 1 Corinthians 10:13. No temptation has overtaken you that is not common to man. God is faithful, and he will not let you be tempted beyond your ability. But with the temptation, he will also provide the way of escape that you may be able to endure it. They have sin that clings closely, but they also have a great cloud of witnesses that he had said before to strengthen their faith. Now, let's look at the metaphor the writer uses. And I know that you probably have heard many sermons on the metaphor, so I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time going through it. I'll just hit the basic stuff for maybe of you that aren't familiar with the metaphor of a runner. If you've read any of the Apostle Paul, you've no doubt heard it. Even through Christ, actually, you may not realize, but he even picks up some of the same language, not just Paul. Verse 1, therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. The runners then did not wear Nikes and running tights like I do whenever they ran. Actually, neither one of those would be a pretty sight, but they didn't do that. They stripped down, if you've seen any of the pictures and any of the drawings and stuff like that, if you've been to museums or if you have books, they stripped down naked whenever they would run, okay? As so not to be hindered by anything that might be clinging to them and be a snare, and that is a catch on their legs. Okay, I mean, you guys know, I know that you guys know this, but just for those that don't, you know, they may be wearing a robe, they may be wearing a loose undergarment, and it's still getting in the way. And what they would do is they would gird it, right? They would tie up the stuff. It would look like a big old huge diaper. And they could go running, but it was so where they wouldn't. But what the real runners would do is they would completely shed all their clothes so that they were not hindered or be tangled up into anything. They were way ahead of the curve on running barefooted too, that's out there today. But so it wouldn't catch, you know, on their legs. They may be running through something that's not necessarily in a coliseum. It could be a rock, could be a branch, could be whatever. Nothing that would stop them from running the race. That's the idea that we see here. And like I said, I know that you know this stuff. But we know what we've been going through here, right? Or at least what they have went through, the Hebrew hearers or readers. The writer fears that they may be shrinking back. He mentioned that in Hebrews 10. So he gave warnings that he gave. He's given them a picture of faithful men. He gave a bunch of warnings in Hebrews 10. He gave a picture in Hebrews 11 of faithful men and women that sacrificed greatly because of their faith. Some that walked in God's way, like Enoch, right? That was one way. It's some that just kept the faith and the promise even though they never realized it, like Abraham living in tents, you know, and Moses' parents even then, right? Some that put their life on their line for their faith, like Rahab. If you think about it, if we went through all those again, you would see he's picked up all different ways that people have responded in faith to certain things that they come across in their course of life, or we may say race. And he's shown you, he's given you a lot of examples here. He says, you have them to strengthen your faith. That's why he's given them, right? You have them to keep you going. You have them to testify that whenever all seemed lost, if we were to go back through that chapter, whenever all seemed lost, God remained true to the promise. And they kept going and going, some not realizing it, some in the middle of the special part of the promise happening, right? And he says, you need to keep going. Picture yourself running a race. And you've got to keep going. And anyone that's ever ran a race knows that whenever you start, right before you start, it all looks good. But once you start the race, you generally get winded, weary, and the first thing you think of is stopping. That's why he's using the race metaphor. You know, it's true. I mean, that's just our nature of our... We can train and train for a race. And we still, once we start, our body immediately wants to stop that. And so that's why he's saying, you need picture it as a race. You may want to stop. You may want to shrink back and stop. But you need to keep moving. These people kept moving. And so here, whenever he says, what he says here is that you've got these people. God's remained true. Picture yourself running a race. Whatever you need to do to run the race successfully, that means you remove whatever. Okay? Whatever. The Greek word here means whatever hinders you. Anything that hinders you from running that race. That's the problem that we have as Christians today. We want to keep that little garment or that little thing that we know is hindering us. Or someone has told us that's a hinder to you, but you still want to wear that article. And he's saying, no, whatever it is. Hinders you in what way? In any way that stops the progress in this race. Now let us keep in mind, he wants his hearers to remain faithful, to finish the race, as Paul said. And he says, here's what he says to do so. Okay, I want you to finish this race. He says, look at the witnesses I just mentioned, that great cloud in the Old Testament, and put off anything that hinders you. I like the fact that the writer is not getting specific. You know, he didn't say that. He says, anything that hinders you. He uses, in the Greek, it's tas, okay? That means each, every, anything, everything, all things that hinder you. He doesn't leave, using that word, he does not leave any room for anything that you could possibly keep running the race with if it's a possibility that it's going to catch on something and weigh you down or stop your progress in the race. And so he doesn't say, put aside this, but now there's other areas we'll look in the Bible where those things, some of those things are named out. But the thing is that there's going to be things that are hindrances for some aren't going to be a hindrance for others, or at least not at that particular spot in the race course. Christ actually named some, but if you think there's money stumbles some, right? Okay, not everybody. Money does not stumble everybody. If you look at even the requirements for a deacon, he can have wealth, but he can't be one that is after, right, ungodly gain or greedy. But he can have wealth, right? So money can be a stumble for some. Passions, selfishness is the ruin of other people. These are the things that he says you have to set these things aside if they're going to be a snare. In Luke 21, verse 34, Christ says, but watch yourself, lest you be weighed down. You know what that is? That's racing metaphor also by Christ. Watch yourself, unless you be weighed down with dissipation, drunkenness, and the cares of this life. The cares of this life. He uses the same terminology there that will trap or entangle you, right? It says, he goes on and says, and the day will come upon you suddenly like a trap. That's that entanglement that the writer of the Hebrews or Paul has talked about also. It may be sexual, maybe money, maybe drink. The cares of this life. Many a husband has broken the commandment to raise and train up their kids in the admonition of the Lord because of the cares of this life. Working, doing whatever it is. Many a mom have broken their commandment to do so because of their love for self or discontentment, and I'm sure you guys can think of other ones. So as we see this, think about, I think we mentioned in Sunday school, Augustine's plea to God when he asked for God to please remove his passions, lust, and sin. You guys remember talking about that? I know we covered it in church history too. But then he followed up by saying, not now, later. Because he knew. He wasn't ready to throw those things aside that hindered him. He had a love for them. Now later on, of course, we know that he did not have a love for it. He hated whenever he had said that. But I've spoken with some in the past that are hindered in their faith. And I believe are shrinking back. Because they've not put off all or anything that hinders them. I've spoken to them on the phone. I've spoken to them in my office. I've spoken to them in various places. And you know, even as like a parent, sometimes you know what the problem is with your kid. He didn't do this or this. And you give them the counsel. You give them the advice. And they blow it off. And then you know, well, now you've done it again. The exact same, you know. And sometimes I've talked to people about things that I could tell is hindering their faith. It's going to cause them to shrink back. It will cause them to stumble. And they're not about to put it off. And it could be a week later, a year later, 2 years later, they get all tripped up and entangled in that very thing that they should have put off. And it was even brought to their attention. And this is what the writer said. If you're a runner, okay, believe me, I can tell. If my shorts don't fit right, or my shirt, whenever I was riding up the hill yesterday, I had an extra water bottle about halfway up that I had an extra, and I didn't want to drink anymore, and I set it in my back pocket, my cycling jersey pocket. And it, I mean, not, I don't want to use the term weighed down, but in a sense it weighed down. And I was riding, and it just, I mean, I can have the water on my bike, but it was in the wrong, and it was, I could tell, and people know it, but they won't put it off. I've seen it. I mean, I've seen it. I guess you say, I've, witnessed it, if I was going to use it in the term that some would use that term. And there are people that know the things that hinder them, and they still won't put it off. I mean, that they truly recognize it. But like Augustine, that's why he said, later, take it away from me, God, but later. And I've seen people give up a good paying job because they know that that job or that atmosphere hinders them in their walk. And they've given that up. I know people that have done that, right? It may be sin that we love or two sins that we love. It could be a friend or a family member that hinders us, but we've known them for so long. We went to school with them. It's my sister, it's my brother, it's whatever it is. And we've known them too long. And we know that that person hinders our walk. And we don't put them off. And he's saying, you remember what he's talking about here, right? In Hebrews? He's talking about the possibility of them falling away from God. This isn't just so you don't have any problems in your life. I mean, this is what he's telling you need to do if you want to run the race and see the goal, which is the reward, the inheritance here. Some hindrances are time. We love our time. We don't want to give our time up for certain things. And it clings to us, and it hinders us from running. We stumble after a while, and we give up. Because the more things get harder, the more things we start collecting as we're running, we're going to give up. We're getting entangled in things. So, you know what? Turn to Colossians 3. I want to take you through a section that Paul, remember, and here in Colossians 3, Paul is speaking to professing Christians. I mean, what a shame that he has to say this to professing Christians. But it's true, because this is the church. Go to Colossians 3. Colossians 3. And Paul says in verses 5 through 8, put to death, therefore, what is earthly in you. He's talking to professing Christians. What's earthly in you? Sexual immorality, impurity, passion, evil desire. He's talking to professing Christians. You understand? I mean, I know that you guys have probably read this thing hundreds of times, but if you think about it, he is talking to people in a church that are meeting on the Lord's Day, listening to this letter being read, and he's saying, put away evil desire. What Christian? Evil desire. Covetousness, which is idolatry. On account of these, the wrath of God is coming. In these you too once walked, when you were living in them, but now you must put them all away. Does that sound like the writer of the Hebrews? Because why? Those are things that will entangle and snare you. Look what he says. You've got to put them all away. Anger, wrath. He's talking about professing Christians. He's like, well, these people came to worship God the day that this letter was read to them. And he's telling them to put away wrath, anger, malice, slander, and obscene talk from your mouth. The writer of the Hebrews is talking to professing Christians. And he's saying anything. Now, Paul doesn't say anything in this sense. He's naming some things, you know. And I can tell you that sexual immorality is a hindrance for Christians. You live it, right? You live for it. And you cannot walk with God while you're walking in sexual immorality. And if you think that you can, right? If you think that, no, I can walk with God and still be walking in sexual immorality. Really? Would you allow that of your pastor? And if not, why not? Because it would be the same thing for you. It's not, you can't do it. Your pastor couldn't do it, you couldn't do it. Many have tried, and usually in secret, and they fail. It's an impossibility. How about covetousness? Thinking that you don't have all that you deserve. I mean, Paul is giving him a list of stuff. Now, I mean, it's nice having a list, but the writer of Hebrews says whatever. But here, you don't have all that you think that you deserve. It's to say, God, I don't have enough. You haven't provided for me that thing, or the thing that just parked in my neighbor's driveway, or whatever it is. That's covetousness. And that is that you're covetous because you think that is what you need, and apparently the Father that hands down all good things from heaven has not given you that thing. In verse 8, Paul says you must put away anger and wrath. He's talking not to, you know, the guy that works across the street, but to Christians. anger and wrath. These are snares. Yet people cling to them. Malice. You have to tell a Christian not to have malice? Evil intent? A desire to do evil? How would a Christian run a race with that? Yet Christians, they refuse to throw out these things. I know people, I've talked to them, that have these things, and they refuse to throw them out. I mean, they're refusing to throw out the garment called malice, or the garment called vengefulness, or the garment called being angry or wrathful. I mean, can you see how that would tie you up? You know, I'll tell you, just personally, one of the things that brings me to the point of rethinking being in the ministry is what's sitting right here. It's Christian on Christian crime. I don't understand it. I don't even get it. It's the backbiting, the gossiping, the slander, which amounts to malice. That's an intent to do evil. Whenever you slander someone, that's an intent to do evil. I hate it so much that this is whenever I would, you know, I get around and I hear it from Christians, and it's whenever I don't want anything to do with it. Truthfully, I would love to be, you know, You know, back whenever you're looking at Athanasius, whenever he went to be a monk in the desert in Egypt, sometimes whenever you see this Christian on Christian crime, not hating my neighbor because they're this and they're partying all the time, I'm talking about Christians snipping and backbiting at other Christians, and a lot of times in their same congregation. This is what he's telling you, you've got to put this away. You cannot run a race like that. It's such a hindrance to race, yet many cling to it, and it's their life. Malice, backbiting, gossiping is the opposite of unity. You cannot backbite and gossip about someone, let's just say, in the walls of this church, and be in unity. It's an impossibility. How do we run the race then? How are we going to be Christ's feet, his arms, and his lips if there's division like that? You can't. You're hindering the work of Christ and the kingdom of Christ within the Mount Reformed Church. I'm not just talking about, but you know, it's in every church. It's the opposite of unity. It retards the body from moving and acting for Christ. Now, if you want freedom, not like Augustine did, which was sometime later, but freedom, today, we're told here, to be a faithful athlete, to be a faithful Christian, you got to put things off that hinder you. And you guys all know what they are. I know the things that hinder me. You know, and that's why sometimes I'm surprised whenever I ask people, about how long do you pray or whatever? It's like, I could go on, but I only pick certain aspects of things that hinder me in the morning. Otherwise, I would have a sweet hour of prayer. We always have something to pray for ourselves, even. But here, you're never, ever going to be able to run a race if you're weighed down. Christ himself said it. I just read it in Luke. Christ said, do not be weighed down. The cares of this life and these different things. Paul is saying it here. The writer is saying it. The writer, if you recall, has been telling them of their need for endurance, chapter 10. Right? He comes right out and says, you need endurance. And then now he says, after he says you need endurance, and he gives you this picture of this great cloud of witnesses, he says, therefore, since we're surrounded by a great cloud of witnesses, let us also, guess what he's saying? Let us also lay aside. What is he implying about those people that we just read about? They did lay aside those things that were hindering them to run the race. Let us run with, and he says, with endurance. Again, if you look at the bookmarks or the bookends, chapter 10, right just a few verses before chapter 11, he says, you're in need of endurance. And then he talks about witnesses, and then he talks about the witnesses. And then he talks about witnesses, and he says, you need to run with endurance. It's kind of like a double bookend, if you look at it. He says we'll need to endure yet again, and this is because we are always running. You guys understand that, right? It's not a race like a regular race that ends. Whenever I went on my ride yesterday, it ended. You know, and then I go home. No, this is a race that continues. It does not end until your life ends. And that's what he's telling you. You've got to have endurance because this is a race that doesn't go. They already gave up the property, right, at one point joyfully. We know in Hebrews 10. But it could be 10 or 15 years later, they're back to affliction. The race isn't over. That was a stage of the race. But the race isn't over. That's why he says you need to endure. They endure the first 20 miles. They're going to have to endure the next 20 miles. Now look at the last bit at the end here. He says, the race that is set before us. You know what he's talking about there, right? Talk about the course. There's been a course that has been set before you. A race course is marked out on a track or through the woods. Okay? That's what he's telling us. There's a race course, a path that is set before each one of us. And we must run the course that is before us. Now, you go, well, sure, I get that. No, I don't know if you get that. Whenever I was running a lot, I used to run the same courses over and over again in training. Over and over and over, the same ones. I could tell you, I could look at my watch, I could tell you what my time was, but I'd run the same courses over and over again. But whenever I would race, I did not know that course that I'm racing that well. I knew the area that I covered, but I didn't know it. Many times I wouldn't know it at all, and I hated it whenever I would race. And Laura will tell you, whether it's running for fun or biking for fun, even today, if I do not know every bend and turn that I'm going to be on, right? Every hill, whatever it is, right? Water crossing, before I actually do it, many times I won't do it. One of my weird, quirky things. I gotta know what it is. I can recall a race that went through Paramount Ranch there in Agoura. It's where, you know, you see the MASH helicopter flying by, and they've got a ghost town thing there, and it's a bunch of movies. All sorts of stuff has been filmed there, but it's they had a whole bunch of things there. Well, it's in the hills. It was a cross country race, and I was dating Laura then. But it's a cross country race, and it went up hills, across fields with foxtails. It had two or three water crossings through Malibu Creek. And, up hills, a couple of ravines. I mean, it was just, you know, stuff. And I had no idea what lied ahead. But that was the race course, if I can use this terminology, that was set before me. And I had to run it. The race director set up the course. He knows every bend, every turn, every hill, every water crossing. He knows it. Straightway, downhill, uphill, obstacle, anything that's there, he knows it because he has set that race course. And that's the race course that's been set up for you. Not necessarily for me, you understand, right? If you will, if I can use the terminology, the race director has set up a race course that's been set before you and you and you. Now, we're all going to finish, hopefully, at the same place with the same reward, the inheritance, the possession, everything that the writer of Hebrews has been talking about here, right? But the course set before us is different for each one of us. Okay? Do we have to go through the things that the people in the Hebrews that we're reading about going through? Well, I pray not. Okay? And Rahab didn't have to go through the same things as Enoch, right? And you see what I'm saying? So there's a different course that's been set before you. And so the course set before us differs. We may not know every turn. Let me tell you something. You won't know every turn. It'll be the kind of course that I hate, in a sense. Not knowing the hills. Not knowing the crossings. Not knowing the obstacle. Right? Not knowing what the weather... Whatever it is. And that's why he's telling us we need to shed off whatever, to put off whatever may hinder us. Could get a narrow course, could get a wide one, it could be foxtails. Okay, try not taking off your shoes and running, or socks, and try running through a field of foxtails. It hinders you. I had to stop and pull out foxtails before I could keep running. You know, and so there's things like that. That's why he's saying to shed these things off. Okay, now our individual courses may join here and here. If you've ever read Pilgrim's Progress, Or you have Christian going down and then he meets up with so-and-so. That's because their race course just happens to meet up for a time. And then they go off this way and the other one goes off that way. But the course has been set before us. We don't know what it is. So we have to prepare for what we know. And so here, we have this course set before us. The director, if you will, has put this course in place. He set it before you. His instructions are to run it. Right? That's his instructions. To run that course. That's why he set it up. Okay? Now, he gives a little briefing before, after, and during, or before and during the race here on how to run it. And so what he does here is he gives us encouragement and he gives us warnings. Make sure that you don't do this. Keep doing that. Don't forsake the assembly, which is the habit of some, because he's talking about apostasy. And then don't go on sinning deliberately, right? But then he talks about where to be faithful. And then he shows us past athletes that have been successful. And he says, this is how they did it. This is what they did whenever they came across this obstacle or that obstacle. You see what I'm saying? In the course that was set before them. And so he says, look to them for guidance or on how to run it, but put off anything that hinders you from running your course. The goal and the end is the same for all of us, but the course is going to be vastly different. Now, there's many similarities in our course, like there were for the Hebrews. Many of them had lost their house or put in prison, but at different times and different places, the courses are going to seem the same, but they're all a little different. So here he's saying, you know, no one's going to run the race with the shoelaces untied, right? No one's going to do that, okay? Dragging a rope with hooks hanging from it as you're running? Well, you wouldn't do that because that would entangle on something and hold you up, right? It's not rocket science here. I mean, it's a pretty easy metaphor that he's giving. Now, what other advice does he give? Look at verse 2 in Hebrews 12. Looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured... There's our word again. Looks like we have another example. He endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of God, at the right hand of the throne of God. He's still using the race metaphors here for Christ, isn't he? Because he's talking about endurance, right? But he also has a couple more. He wants us to look at Jesus. Now remember, whenever he uses the term Jesus, in Hebrews especially, instead of the Christos or Christ, he's pointing us to what? The human Jesus in the flesh. Not that he wasn't God, but that time on in during his life that he was a human. Okay, that's why he's using the term Jesus there. Now, depending on your translations, it says, put your eyes on Jesus. He's the founder. Now, many people look at this. Whenever we run the race, we're running the race, and we're looking way ahead to the goal, and we're setting our eyes on Jesus. And if we just keep setting our eyes on Jesus, we're just going to keep running to Jesus. That's not what we'll see here. It's not the context. Even though I know some people, well, we should do that. But here's what he's saying. He is the founder. Some versions say pioneer. Some may say author. I know, with respect to William Tyndale, why he used author. Because he was trying to undo some Roman Catholic ideas on the word. But pioneer or founder would be a fine definition. So author. But I know it's our beloved translations. And ever since Tyndale came around and said author, it's been author. But again, just pick up any lexicon. You could say author in a sense of it's the beginner of something. But pioneer or founder is good. Now, I like pioneer myself. I know that that's one that we're not used to, but some translations have that. I don't know if you have one at home. But I like pioneer for it shows not only a founder, right? But with pioneer was what? Is the first at doing something prior to everyone else doing it. Hence, some of your translations could even say forerunner, which would be very, very close. Okay. But pioneer, so as a pioneer, you're not only the founder of what it is that you're doing because you're pioneering it. But in a sense, you're pioneering. You're the first to do what no one else has done yet. And that's, do you see what he's talking about the race? He's just mentioned a whole bunch of people that weren't the first, in a sense, but the one that actually did it here. Jesus was the forerunner or the pioneer of our faith in a sense, promise. He is the finisher or has finished, if I can use gospel language, has finished what he set out to do. Jesus started this race. He ran the course that was set before him, and he completed that race. Notice it speaks of him enduring also, The writer says, you looked at a cloud of witnesses I laid out, but now look to Jesus. He started the race. He was the pioneer. He was the first one that would really do this, right? And he finished it. Notice the terms here. It's even racing terms here. For the joy set before him, endured the cross. Or endure the race, if you want to put it, because that's the terminology he's using. We have reward. We are running a race. We're looking for the prize, the reward, or the joy that comes with finishing the race. Jesus had a reward or joy set before him, and then he even says what it was. It was at the completion of his race to sit at the right hand of the Father. That's the context of that. Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, was the pioneer. He's talking about a race that we must run, a race that others have run, and then he says, look, Christ is the pioneer. He's the founder of it. He started it, and he endured because he had his eyes on the joy, which was sitting at the right hand of the Father once he finished his race. So, you see, here, he endured many hardships, it goes on. The one that ran before us, he ran the course laid out before him, which was not a very pleasant course, was it? But he ran it anyways, and he completed it, he finished it, and he is now sitting at the right hand of the Father. So he looked at the joy set before him, or set in front of him, that he would do that. And that's the very thing that he's been telling them to do. Concentrate on your reward, your inheritance, your possession, the joy that has been set before you. Now, notice, people in the Old Testament, the great cloud, had some suffering, right? Some of them had some suffering. But they endured. Jesus, if you notice, purposely suffered because he too looked at the inheritance that he would receive. Because of that joy, that inheritance, it says that he endured. He disregarded shame. He endured hardships. And the servant is not greater than the master. Look down at verse 3, Hebrews 12. Consider him who endured for sinners such hostility against himself, so that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted. In your struggle against sin, you've not yet resisted to the point of shedding blood. Now, they've known hostility. As I said, we've read many references here, right? Jesus has known them to the point of dying. Guess what he had? He had towns and governments and people in those towns that despised him, just like they have. Right? That struck him, that spit upon him, that tried to silence him, that tried to get him to change his doctrine to be a little bit more in line with the rest of society. So you can see the race metaphor is still sitting here. He says here, that you may not grow weary or faint-hearted. That's more race metaphor. Running wears you down, right? You get weary, you grow faint-hearted, you're ready to stop running, ready to turn back. But take it all together, he says, you need to endure and you need to put off. Because if it's getting hard and faint-hearted, you don't stop, you strip off something else that's enduring you to make it easier for you to finish that race. Now, if we were to take chapter 10 up to where we are now and ask, how do I endure in my faith so that I run well and finish? Well, one, you would say, well, you know what? This writer has taken a look from Genesis. And then all he even worked himself through the history and the prophets, where he said he didn't really have time to talk about it, but we know the things he mentioned. He took us from Genesis to Malachi. And he said, consider these people. Consider the Old Testament to strengthen your New Testament faith. Okay? So he's done that. And then he talks about various situations, and he says, look to Jesus, the forerunner, who lived out the same race but did so to the point of death. You know what the writer's just done? Do you see what he's done here? He's given us these people to strengthen our faith. He's given us Christ to strengthen our faith. He's told us where to get it now then. Do you see what he's done here to get us to strengthen our faith so that we don't fall away? He says, read, study, consider, meditate on all of the Bible. And you go, where do you get that he said to study on all the Bible? Well, he's mentioned in Hebrews 11 from Genesis to Malachi. And he says to consider Jesus, and we say the New Testament is a testimony of Jesus. So what has he just given us to strengthen our faith from Genesis to Revelation? He's just told us, if you want to stop from falling into apostasy, study your Old Testament and the faithfulness of the people in the Old Testament. And then he goes, oh, you know what? Also, look to Jesus. Well, now he's just told us to look at in the New Testament. Where else are we going to find out our information of Christ but through the New Testament? And so you see what he's done here. He's told us to stop ourselves from apostasy. I mean, this may be a new thing to you, but he's told us if we want to stop ourselves from falling into apostasies, we need to pick up our scriptures and glean from them, to consider all the scriptures. Now, that makes sense. I'll read a text that you know well, but now you can even see it come alive. 2 Timothy 3:16, all scripture is breathed out by God and profitable for teaching. All scripture. For reproof, for correction, for training in righteousness, that a man may be, it says, competent, but actually it is brought to maturity or perfection, equipped for every good work. Yes, Scripture will bring you to the completion or maturity, will train you for righteousness. That's the opposite of falling into apostasy, right? I mean, righteousness is opposite. So we look from Genesis to Revelation, considering those who went on before us in Christ Jesus. Our faith is strengthened. Remember, we covered this last week. It's not from new, some, you know, like today you'll get, I need some fresh wind, some fresh spirit to get my faith moving. He's told us to go to the Old Testament, to old history, to strengthen our faith. And now he's told us to go to the New Testament. He's not saying, look for something fresh. He's saying, you do it the old-fashioned way. You pick up the Bible. You consider and read, meditate on it. And you know what the Word of God will help us do? What we've already read. It tells us, whenever we read, what it is that we should put off. We read some of them. I can tell you, if you keep reading your Bible, you'll find more things. It'll tell us what we're supposed to put on. And it will show us the faithfulness of people that have went on before us. The whole line of his thinking is to go to your scriptures that you have. Now, there are many other places that tell us, as I said, what we should put off, what we should clothe ourselves. And like it or not, we also see, I know that some of you don't look at the race metaphor like that, but we also see that the race laid before us is not held in a coliseum on a flat track with straightaways and then a slow turning oval with no gravel, with no rocks, with no hills, with no thing to grab onto us. It's not that kind of a racetrack, is it, that he's talking about? We know just by looking at Christ and the other people's race that they ran, he's not talking about that. Right? It's nothing with slow, steady, turning corners. Nice gravel or running on a rubber track mat. It's not that. There's going to be rocks and rivers and the valleys of shadows and death. There's going to be all those things that are going to be within the race. But here's the thing. The race director is aware of the race that he set before you. He's aware of it. Right? He knows what you can handle and what you cannot handle. Right? He's given us these things that we can complete them. He's given us athletes to read about, right? He's told us to hinder anything, but he is not giving you a course that you cannot handle. He's never, ever tempting you more than what you can handle. But there's a race course that's been set out for us there. And we see that some, it's put off the pleasures of sin, it says, like Moses did, right? The scriptures say Abraham set aside business and family. Remember, whenever he left. Okay, there are things that he pushed off so he could run the race. Moses pushed off the pleasures of sin so he could run the race, right? I mean, a lot of these people have shown that they've given up things. They've endured afflictions for that. And the Bible is a witness or a testimony of those things. It's witnessing, it's testifying. The Bible's not watching. It's testifying of those things. It testifies the covenant of God and the people that have ran the race before us. I pray that these aren't just going to be familiar metaphors to you running the race, but you actually think about them. Think about the race director. Think about the course. Think about the people that have ran similar races and learned from them. There's nothing new. You think the race is too coarse. That race director will not classify you in a race that you cannot run. I hope that if we look at Scripture, we see that it will mature us. It will perfect us. And that we must put off anything and everything that hinders. I hope these aren't just going to be words to us. Or that we think that we won't get entangled. Now, some of you know what always ends up hindering you. You know it. I know that you know it. And I just pray, as the writer does, for his people, that you would cast it off. Let's pray, please.